On this episode of the podcast, more church fire problems, missionaries arrested in Laos, with another exclusive interview or two that you'll only see here on The Hot Zone.
This is The Hot Zone. Engaging with the news in a whole new way, international war correspondent Chuck Holton brings insight into areas of crisis and lets you help those affected.
Hey, folks. There's a lot to get to today, so let's get to it. Yesterday, I touched on the untimely death of a Christian missionary in Paraguay named Wayne Goddard. Now, he's my age, 50 years old. Paraguay's not normally associated with heightened travel risk. Most places in the country are very safe, but, you know, Wayne wasn't working in most places. The place where he lived was near what they call the tri-border region. The State Department warns that transnational criminal organizations facilitate the illicit trafficking of arms, narcotics, and other goods in Paraguay, particularly along Paraguay's eastern border with Brazil, including that tri-border region of Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina. Now, coupled with the lack of sufficient police enforcement, the involvement of these crime organizations only heightens the risk in these areas. Now, we've been doing a lot of reporting this week on the risks being faced by missionaries around the globe. And today, I've got two special guests to talk about that subject further. So I've got my friend Terry Reed, who's been a New Tribes missionary for many years, here to talk to us more about the risks that New Tribes missionaries face as they go out to places, remote areas around the globe. Terry, thanks for being with us.
You know, just for clarification, you know, New Tribes Mission is now Ethnos 360. They changed their name back in about a year ago. But yeah, so I'd be happy to talk with you, Chuck.
So they rebranded as Ethnos 360 to try to, I don't know, who knows why they did that. I like New Tribes. But anyway, just to be confusing maybe. Nevertheless, so we just saw the news come out, the tragic news out of Paraguay. This guy, Wayne Goddard, that was murdered in his village where he was working. I don't know. You probably don't know anything about all that. But can you just tell me what kind of risks do these missionaries face when they're out in the field?
Sure. So as far as Wayne Goddard goes, I don't know many details. You know, as you said, they have not released a lot, probably out of respect to the family. So I don't have a lot of personal details, though we know some of his friends. You know, there's a lot of risks, Chuck, for missionaries because they tend to travel, particularly missionaries like those in Ethnos 360 that go to remote locations where you're far away from the law, you're far away from police, there's very little government interference just because of the distance and the difficulty of the places, kinds of places they live. So they have, you know, they face risks in things like just difficulty getting into places. You know, we've got friends that travel 12, 14 hours over boat just to get to some of these little islands they work on, others that hike for days to get into villages where they work, others have long, difficult drives, difficult flights. Only way in and out is by helicopter. So, of course, you got those kinds of physical challenges and dangers that are inherent in those kinds of trips. And those tend to be actually probably, in the long run, the greater risks. But in some of these places where we work, you know, of course, there's illegal activity happening in areas around places like that are remote because there is no government interference. So, you know, you may have people doing all kinds of illegal activities in the jungles around you, and just by virtue of the fact that you're a foreigner, there's an inherent risk because they don't know who you know, they don't know who you're talking to, and so, you know, you run those risks of guerrillas, kidnapping, in this case, as what happened with Wayne Goddard, murder, you know, whether it's robbery because they perceive you as having a lot more than them, or if it's just because they think that you're an inherent risk because they don't, as I said, they don't know who you're talking to.
Yeah, that's right. And you yourself spent a lot of years in Mexico translating for Guarijiro? Is that how you say that?
The Guarijiro. Yeah, that's pretty close. Guarijiro.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the area where you guys worked and how long you were there, what it was like, and why you left.
Sure. So, you know, for us, a lot of the dangers there, of course, were, you know, that because these areas are so remote, the cost of getting anything out there is very expensive. So the cost of living for people is actually pretty high. And so they would tend to get into illegal activities, cultivation of drugs, other things like that, to support their families. You know, there's a lot of pressure to provide in an area where crops don't grow particularly well anyway. And so, of course, with those kinds of illegal activities also come people with guns that protect their crops, people with guns to take their crops, and things like that. So, you know, Chuck, we've talked before that, you know, we've been in some pretty sticky situations where people have, you know, we've been in some danger. As far as part of the reason we left, you know, we had, actually where we met Chuck is when we had moved out of the village for several years because of fighting related to the drug war that's been ongoing in Mexico for a long time. Thankfully, we were eventually able to move back to the village. But then, of course, our oldest daughter, she was about 14 at the time. She was now marriageable material in the village, and some very unseemly types were taking a real notice of her. She's an attractive young lady, and so one of the reasons we knew it was time for us to move on is because now there was physical danger for her as well as for us.
Yeah, that's right. And out there, you know, those narco traffickers just pretty much take what they want, and your daughters get, like you say, they're a couple of the most beautiful little girls I've ever seen. And one of those guys comes into the village one day and says, "Mine," to your daughter. There's not a whole lot you're going to be able to do about it. So I think it was prudent at that point to say, let's go do our translation work somewhere else. Tell me a little bit about the work that you were doing and are continuing to do among that tribe.
Sure. Okay, so in, let's see, June of 1999, we became members of what was then New Tribes Mission, now Ethnos 360. And we moved to Mexico in August of 1999, and we spent the next 16 years there until we had the situation, of course, with our daughter and her safety. And about the same time, my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal colon cancer. And so we actually returned here to Southern Oregon, where we're now here taking care of my mother-in-law. My father-in-law has since passed away, and we're here taking care of my mother-in-law. But I'm thankful to be able to continue in my work as a Bible translator in the Guadalquivir language. And through means like things like WhatsApp, I've been able to communicate closely with a young Guadalquivir man. He and his wife are pastoring the church there that we planted, and continuing to work. And he's also doing some translation himself. And we are just about around 90% of the New Testament now translated into Guadalquivir. And along with that, I'm also doing some Bible translation consulting, just giving some direction, doing on-site checks, helping other Bible translators in the process of Bible translation. Because, as you know, it's a complicated task, and it takes a lot of eyes on the project, so that when we're done, we can really say that, "Thus says the Lord," in whatever language we're working in.
Yeah, it is really an amazingly complex task. Because I think people don't realize that, you know, you go into a place like that, that is a tribe who did not have a codified language. Am I right? They did not have a written language when you arrived. Is that correct?
That's correct. There were other missionaries who had begun some work, but in the time we were there, we finalized the alphabet, worked on the writing system, did some grammar write-ups, things like that, and then began the process of translation and some literacy training as well to teach the Guadalquivir to make the jump from Spanish to their heart language.
Yeah, Guadalquivir. I remember that just so fascinated me hearing your story, because here you are going to a group of people, only a couple thousand Guadalquivir left in the world, in a very, very remote area. This language that they speak is essentially ancient Aztec, and it's not a written language. So you're going there and you're performing a public service for this tribe by codifying their language, putting it into written form, and that takes years of work and learning it yourself in order to do that, and then starting the process of translating the Bible into their language and making it make sense according to their culture. Unbelievably complex, incredibly hard work. But, man, talk about working for the kingdom. And so we've been very, very glad to have been able to be a part of it by supporting you guys for a few years. And I can't wait to see the finished product. It is a very risky thing, folks, for Christians around the world, especially missionaries who are going into dangerous places, who are doing biblical translation, who are bringing the gospel, the good news of Christ's love to people. And we just saw that in the last couple of days with several missionaries who were traveling around in Laos. So I've got Eric Blevernick, the operations director for Vision Beyond Borders. And Eric, tell me a little bit about your ministry and what you guys do.
Sure. Vision Beyond Borders is a ministry that started by Patrick Klein about 25, 30 years ago. Original mission was to bring Bibles into closed areas, basically Bible smuggling.
Wow. So you guys work all over the place. So tell me about what happened in Laos.
Okay. So in Laos, we had a team going in a couple of weeks ago that they went in with gospel tracts and MP3 players that were loaded with Bibles and other Christian literature. And so they were going by motorbike into some of the more remote villages in northern Laos. And as they were doing so, someone alerted police to them, and they were detained as they were handing out the gospel tracts. And so that happened on April 8th.
And then what happened after that?
So they were taken by police, taken to the provincial police headquarters and questioned. And then they were released to a guest house in Luang Namtha, in the northern province there in Laos. And their passports were taken. So they were held for investigation, basically. And so they were held for 10 days until they were released today.
Oh, wow. And so they're on their way home now, be home for Easter.
Right. Yeah, that's what we've been praying for, is that they would be able to get home in time for Easter. And so we're thrilled with this news that they were taken to the border in just a few hours ago and released to Thailand.
Well, I was afraid that they had been put in some kind of Laotian prison. That would not be a good place to spend 10 days. But
right.
Glad that they got put in a guest house instead. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that Laos is a communist country, and that when you go to Laos, you very often get followed, just like you would in former Soviet Russia or something like that. And you're supposed to have a minder with you all the time, and it's kind of hard to ditch those guys sometimes. But this is a very important ministry, important work that you're doing, getting the gospel to these people, because I really believe that it's the best way to improve those cultures and improve the lot of the lives of those people. Long term, it will make their country and the world a better place. So I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
Now, the investigation is just beginning into what caused the fire at Notre Dame this week. But already some whack job decided it'd be a good idea to burn down one of the United States' best-known cathedrals, St. Patrick's in New York City. This joker apparently tried to enter the church with 4 gallons of gasoline, 2 cans of lighter fluid, and lighters. And then he said, oh, it's only because my car's out of gas. Wow. What's interesting is that the cops already had an eye on this guy, and they had their counterterrorism police outside, so they were able to stop him quickly before anything got lit on fire. So the cleanup's already underway at Notre Dame in Paris, only days after that world-famous church went up in flames, and well over €500 million has been pledged to rebuild it. Now, some people are actually criticizing the fact that people are donating money for that, pointing out that there are hungry people around the world who could use that money. Okay, that's fair, but let me explain something to you here. First of all, Notre Dame might in fact be covered by insurance if the true cause of the fire turns out to be an accident, in which case the donated funds certainly could go to feed hungry people, and maybe that'll happen. Let's hope so. Also, charity's not a zero-sum game. Giving doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. In fact, generosity begets more generosity in 3 ways. First, giving feels good, and the more you give, the more likely you will want to continue giving as much as you can. Second, when you give to charity, it motivates others to do the same. And third, people who receive true charity, as opposed to, you know, entitlements from the government or something like that, that's not actually charity, they tend to want to pass those good vibes along out of gratitude for what they've received. Now, on yesterday's podcast, I talked about Catherine, a single mother of two. We helped start a business so she could provide for her children without leaving them unsupervised, playing in the street all day. And then suddenly, I got this flood of hate on Facebook by people insisting that we should only help needy people and veterans in the United States. I mean, how dare we give to keep a couple of little dirty brown kids from starving? The nerve. Well, Some of the comments were incredibly instructive, though, about just how poor America's public school system must be. There were dozens of comments telling this woman, who is from Venezuela, living in Colombia, over 2,000 miles from the United States, that she needs to stay out of our country. Apparently, these people think Colombia is somewhere near Phoenix or something. But this guy shared my post with his people, help Americans first, with American apostrophe S. That was a very common refrain. The whole charity begins at home thing. Well, you know, charity might indeed begin at home, but it doesn't have to stay there or end there. And I'd love to take one of these people with me to Colombia and let them see the poverty that there is on the border there, which is frankly worse than anything you'll find in the United States. And I'd like to see this guy, Joe, look in Catherine's starving children faces and tell them, sorry, kids, I only like to help people who look like me. Then there was this gem, a Venezuelan soldier who defected from the military and is taking a stand for his country at great peril to his own life and that of his family, posted this message in Spanish. Translated, it says, may God save the United States from the tragedy we're living in my country. The first response to this message, well, this warm-hearted American woman wrote, this is America, we speak English. Classy, just wow. So finally, to please the we only help Americans crowd, I put up this plea for Dr. Doug Berbella, who was shot delivering aid in Haiti last week. But hey, he's a white guy. He looks just like you. And some people actually stepped up. One of the people that stepped up to help this guy was my friend Imran Jilani, who's a Pakistani Muslim asylum seeker in the United States, waiting for his turn for an asylum hearing. Now, apparently Imran didn't get the memo that we only help our own. In fact, his generosity put that of many Christians to shame. Now, there are about 130 million households in the United States with a median income of over $56,000. Now, since only half the U.S. population claims to be Christian, let's just pretend that half of the United States doesn't give a penny and the other half actually follow the biblical mandate to tithe on their income. That means the average Christian home should be giving about $100 a week. That's 107, I think, to be exact, to the needy. That'd come out to nearly $32 billion a month being given to charity just in the United States. To give you a sense of how much that is, the U.S. government's currently spending about $8.7 billion a month on feeding the poor in America. So we could feed all the hungry people in the United States, and the government wouldn't have to do anything, and we'd still have $23 billion a month left over. My point is, there's more than enough to help our neighbors, and even a little left over to help other people that don't look like us. In my experience, generous people tend to be generous to everybody, not just those they're closest to. So go ahead and help the people God puts in front of you. And if you want to help me, help the people that God puts in front of me, well, let's do that. Let's make the world just a little bit better. Join me, would you? Americans are the most generous people group on the planet, bar none. And we know that giving is more blessed than receiving. So let's be generous. Let's give. Now that's it for today's Hot Zone. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next week.
The Hot Zone is produced by Amy Holton and Livefire Media. Copyright 2019.